I think it's appropriate to conclude with a talk on Megillat Esther given by a man-woman team recreating the events of the Megillah, where the redemption was brought about by a man-woman team, according to the Midrash, also husband and wife. The well-known pun Megillat Esther alludes to the tension between the dialectical interplay in the book between Galui, the revealed, and Seter, the concealed. What is revealed in the book is far removed from the usual themes of the Tanakh, the political intrigues, machinations of the Persian court, probably the King Xerxes, presiding over a hedonistic society. The main activity of the society seems to be drinking parties, which are mentioned 10 times in the Megillah, and the king adds, there are handouts around, I don't know where they are exactly.
There's one over there on the table.
Okay. And the king adds to the praiseworthy habit of drinking the equally praiseworthy habit of womanizing. What is blatantly missing in the Megillah is most famously the name of God, but the other main themes of the Tanakh also seem to be absent. The land of Israel, Jerusalem, the temple, nationhood, religious worship. What we would like to show is that these themes are not in fact missing from Megillat Esther, but hidden, encrypted within the book, and that tracing the way in which the book alludes to these themes contains important messages both about the festival of Purim and about its novel message of redemption.
I think it's important to remember that at the time that we think Megillat Esther took place, which is probably between 485 and 465 BCE, the Persian era, at the very same time, there is a Yishuv Yehudi, the Yehuda. There is a settlement of Jews in the land of Israel, a struggling settlement that is trying to maintain the temple, the service in the Beit HaMikdash, that is trying to maintain some kind of sovereignty under the rule of the Persians. It's a very poor population. They are beset with drought, poverty. We know that Nehemiah and Ezra are trying to help them, but it's very, very difficult. And I think it's interesting to keep that in mind, that there is sort of perhaps these two competing communities of Jews simultaneously sort of asserting their identity. But whereas the Jewish identity in the land of Israel is very clear, even though they're struggling, in a sense, to create a new Jewish peoplehood in the land of Israel with the help of Ezra and Nehemiah, what we discover that's going on in the land of Persia and its environs is, and the empire, really, is that there seems to be a lack of Jewish identity, a lack of self, of nationhood, even, and what we're going to present is both what we see in the Megillah and also what's missing from the Megillah. And I think a way to begin is, if you look on your handout, before I get to the comparison with the book of Daniel, I'd like to just bring a well-known midrash that appears in the Bavli, in Megillah Yud Bet Ayin Aleph, number one. Shalu Talmidav et Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. The students of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai asked him, Mipnei ma nitchayvu soneihem shel Yisrael shehayu boto dor klaya. Why were the Jews, it's a euphemism here, why was a destruction decreed upon them? The idea being that there is no such phenomenon, in, at least in the Bible, in Jewish history, that is causeless. There has to be a cause. There has to be a reason why one day out of the blue, some anti-Semite decides to destroy all of the Jewish people. There has to be an inner reason, not just the typical anti-Semitic position. Amar lahem, imru atem. He said to his students, like a good teacher, tell me what you think. I think this is a well-known response, because they enjoyed the festive meal of Oto Rasha, of Achashverosh. In other words, the Jews participated fully in the festivities of Achashverosh and of the court. They had no, seemed to have absolutely no problem with eating and drinking there and enjoying whatever largesse was distributed. Amar lahem, im kein, shebishushan habirai yehargu, shal kol haolam kulo lo yehargu. But this is not an argument. They answer because, he answers them because, this is true of Shushan. But what about the rest of the empire? They weren't all there at that famous party. Amru lo emar lanu ata. Okay, so let us know. Amar lahem, mipnei shishtachavu latzelem. And he answered, and Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai answered, because they bowed down to the tzelem. This is a very strange answer. And what tzelem are we talking about? Did they really bow down to idols? Was this, were they idolaters? Amar lehem, Amru lo, v'chi masel panim yesh badavar. The assumption is they really didn't do it, you know, they didn't really mean it. They just pretended to write down. Oh, excuse me.
Okay, v'chi masel panim yesh badavar means, so why in fact were they spared? Okay.
No, I know that. That I know. Okay. Okay, so I didn't translate it well. Okay. So he said to them, in other words, the point is that the argument is, but why should they be they be destroyed when they only did it perfunctorily, they only did it outwardly? Inside, they really didn't believe in idols. So the answer is, Amalahem heim lo asu ela lifanim, af HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo asa imahem ela lifanim. Because they pretended to worship idols, so God only pretended to destroy them. In other words, there's a kind of like a cat and mouse game going on here is the way I see it. You know, everybody is sort of filling a certain role, acting in a certain way, but there's a lack of sincerity on the part of what people are doing. They're participating in the party of Achashverosh. They're enjoying what Persia offers, but inside they know that they're still Jews, but nevertheless they present themselves outwardly as Persians. And so they will be, as it were, outwardly punished, but ultimately when they reassert their Jewish identity, then they will indeed be spared. But I think what's going on here is a statement about galut. In galut, it is very, very hard for a Jew to identify fully as a Jew. He has to negotiate the outside world. How does he present himself? How does he practice his religion? What choices does he make? And these are very difficult questions for anybody living in galut. Who wants to, on the one hand, to succeed and to flow with the society, but on the other hand, wants to maintain his Jewish identity. Everybody sitting in this room has made that choice, okay? And Avi and I have also made choices. But every Jew living, I mean, you know, we lived in America for quite a few years, so every Jew makes that choice about what is his Jewishness and how is it acted, how is it practiced in the world which is not Jewish. Okay, I'd like to continue this theme by contrasting the choices that are made in Megillat Esther as opposed to another Jew and his fellow cohorts, and that is Daniel. And I think that's a book that's not really well known. It's not really that people are not that familiar with it, so I'll just point out a few comparisons between the character of Daniel and his fellow men and what choices that they made and what was going on in contrast in Megillat Esther. The first thing that we'll talk about names, okay? Names are also a very important question when you live in the Galut. Do you take a Jewish name, a Hebrew name? Do you take a Loazi name, a non-Hebrew name? How do you present yourself to the world? In the case of Daniel, you'll see it says in the first source there that Daniel and his fellows, I guess you'd call them, were given names by Sar HaSarisim. They were given Babylonian names. By the way, Daniel was a part of the first Galut of Babel, which was about 590 before the destruction, about 11 years before the destruction of the first temple. The elite of Jerusalem society was exiled, and Daniel was picked out by the Babylonian elite as being a kind of Yosef character, actually, in the court of the Babylonians. And so he and his fellows were given Babylonian names, but it was foisted on them. They did not choose these names. The names were Belshazzar, Hananiah got Shadrach, Mishael got Meshach, and Azariah got Abednego. Okay? Four Babylonian names. On the other hand, what do we read in the Megillah? Ish Yehudi haya b'shushan habira ushmo Mordechai. Mordechai is the name of, is based on the name Marduch, which is a Mesopotamian god. And Vayehi Omein et Hadassa, he Esther. And Esther is generally understood as being Astarte, okay, the goddess. And if you look at number three, if you look at the next page on number three, we'll take one brief look at Rabbi Nechemiah Omer. Do you see Rabbi Nechemiah? Number four, and then you've got Tani Rabbi Omer, Rabbi Yehuda, and then you have Rabbi Nechemiah Omer, Hadassa Shma, V'lama Nikra Shma Esther, Shayu Ovdei Elilim, Korim Ota Kochav Hanoga, Al Shem Estehar. But her name was Hadassa, says Rabbi Nechemiah, so why was she called Esther? Because the other people who lived in her area, in her neighborhood, right, called her Esther because it was the name of a goddess, Noga, okay? So the question of name, how do I call myself in the real world? Do I go by my Hebrew name? Do I go by my Loazi name? Avi here was named Alan. My name is worse. Ruth and Ruth, so you can't say, but Avi's Alan, and then he was Avi. So what is he? How does he present himself to the world? So we solved that problem when we made Aliyah. Okay. So that's one question, because a name is a very important statement about identity. If we look at the next source that go back to the chart, we come to a topic which I think is very, very crucial in the Golah. I think, again, something that we all have experienced, and that is, what do you eat? In Daniel, Vayiman lehem hamelech dvayom biyomom mipat bag hamelech umiyein mishtav ulegadlam shanim shalosh umikzatam yamdu lefnei melech. Vayasem Daniel alibo asher lo yitgael bepat bag hamelech uviyein mishtav. Daniel was presented with the king's bread and wine, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's food, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the officers that he might not defile himself. Daniel keeps kosher. Does Esther keep kosher? Does Mordechai keep kosher? We have absolutely no reference to it, but it would appear that they don't. I mean, Esther doesn't seem to be bothered by drinking with the king, right? She herself, unless she got a special hashgacha for the two mishta'ot that she made, but nevertheless, if we go back to the midrash that we saw, shenehenu misu'udato shel oto rasha, it would appear that the Jews in general did not have a problem drinking wine. Go ahead. Right, right. That's what I'm saying. Right. Okay, so we'll go back to the, forget Esther, we'll go back to the Jews who seemed, that according to the rabbis, nehenu misu'udato shel oto rasha. Right, okay, let's say that. Right, right. Your presence? Okay. Let's say that. In any event, let's put it this way. In Daniel, there's a point is made by Daniel, I will not partake of the king's bread and wine. In Esther, there is no counterpart to that. We're left at the very best with a question mark, okay? In no place does she say, I will not eat, I will not drink, nor does Mordechai. Okay. In addition, lo higida Esther et amavet moladeta, ki Mordechai tziva aleha asher lo tagid. Esther does not identify as a Jew. This is a well-known point. And even when Esther begs for her people and she prostrates herself in front of Ahasuerus, she says, "Ki nimkarnu ani va'ami lahashmid, laharog ulabed." She never says, "Ki nimkarnu ani va'am ha'yehudi, anachnu va'ha'yehudim." Even then, at that very moment when she almost, reveals herself, she leaves out the word Yehudi. Let me just continue, okay? Because I'm sorry. Okay. The next source is in Daniel Perakimel. I'll read it in English because it's in Aramaic. There are certain Jews whom thou hast appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. There is a clear statement here that Daniel and his fellows will not bow down to idols. And let me make one more point about that. And in the last square, Daniel went into his house. Now his windows were open in his upper chamber toward Jerusalem, and he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. We are told explicitly that Daniel, despite the decree of the king, worshipped Hashem three times a day and faced Yerushalayim. Okay? So again, he identifies himself as a Jew. He ignores the decree of the king to bow down to idols, and he is faithful to the Ribono Shel Olam. In the case of the Megillah, we are left with a question mark, which I think has been discussed several times, which is, why did Mordechai not bow down to Haman? Now, it's possible that we have to end. Okay, we'll leave that as a question mark. Right now, nevertheless, we are never told specifically that Mordechai will not bow down to Haman because he represents idolatry or he represents Amalek or anything that is very, very negative and foreign to us. And in addition, we are never told in the Megillah that the Jews pray. We are told, and I'll get back to this later, that they fast. They come together to fast. But it's interesting that the word tefillah does not appear in the Megillah. I think it's instructive. I think, and especially in contrast to Daniel, the Jews are very careful not to overdo it. Okay, even in times when their Jewishness seems to come to the fore, they still seem to hold back and in some way present themselves as this sort of, in a sort of ambiguous way. Okay, I think Avi will take over.
Okay, I'd like to summarize the main points of what Ruthie just pointed out, that the picture that you get of the beginning of the Babylonian exile as reflected in the book of Daniel seems to reflect how Jews in a situation that is definitely very challenging to their Jewish identity and in some cases their divine decrees that threaten their Jewish identity. But the basic picture you get from the book is a picture of Jews who are struggling very hard to maintain their identity. They are declaring themselves to be Jews and they are acting in such a way as to indicate that they remain a distinct force. And interestingly, one of the other messages of the book of Daniel is that this, in fact, earns the respect of the Babylonians, of the king who appoints Daniel to be an advisor. He's well aware of who he is and that he's Jewish. He appoints him to be an advisor. And the people as a whole are very impressed with the Jewish commitment to their God and with God's commitment to them. There are miraculous events in the book of Daniel. And this is the picture that we have of the preservation of Jewish identity at the beginning of the exile. Now, several generations later, in the book of Esther, we seem to have a much more thoroughly assimilated people. They are not self-identifying as Jews. They're not maintaining Jewish names. For all we can tell, they're not maintaining Jewish practices, whether explicit or not, there seems to be no indication that they're maintaining Jewish practices. And so we have a very different picture.
I just want to add one thing. It's been noted that the actual events of Purim take place on Pesach, Okay, Esther come. The decree is on Yud Gimel, and then there's Yud Dalet Tetvav. Esther appears to the king on Tetvav on Pesach. There is no hint in the Megillah at all of the observance of Pesach. Okay, again, it's something that's sort of erased from the book, and yet the fact that the dates are so clearly delineated makes us wonder what happened to Pesach. And I think the Megillah is hinting at the fact that people were not observing the holiday of Pesach.
Even if they may have had matzah at the drinking banquet that she made for Achashverosh, I doubt that they had maror. Actually, the first overtly Jewish act in the book of Esther is by the one who is identified at the beginning of the book as Ish Yehudi. Okay, he is identifiably a Jew. Esther, as Ruthie noted, is not. Okay, she's commanded to hide her Jewish identity. She apparently achieves the position that she achieves by hiding that identity. Mordechai is identified as a Yehudi, and one of the turning points of the book, of course, is when Mordechai refuses to bow down to Haman. Whatever the reason for that may have been, it seems clear from the Megillah, my brother-in-law Rabbi David Silber talked about this yesterday and suggested it's possible to read the Psukim differently, although he ended up preferring this reading as well. When they ask Mordechai, why are you not bowing down to Haman, his answer involves, Ki higid lahem asher hu Yehudi. He said, I'm a Jew. As a Jew, I cannot bow down to Haman. So this is the first overtly Jewish act in the book, and it of course has consequences that I'll come back to in a moment. But before talking about the consequences, I would like to talk a minute about the motivation. Why does Mordechai not bow down to Haman? The answer is not terribly clear. Why can a Jew not bow down to Haman? There are two well-known proposals for it, and my brother-in-law reflected them yesterday, and I just saw them a few minutes ago in a new book on Megillat Esther by Dr. Yoni Grossman, who rehearses the same, basically the same ideas. I think they're pretty well established. One possibility is a religious idea, and the other is a nationalistic idea. The religious idea is based on assuming, as the Midrash says, that Haman wore an idol on him, and therefore bowing down to him would be effectively Avodah Zarah. It's pointed out quite a few years ago by Dr. Gabi Cohen. There is some textual warrant for this in the language of the Megillah. Kor'im u'mishtachavim l'Haman, u'mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. And as Gabi Cohen points out, it's very frequent in the Bible for someone to bow down as a sign of respect to another human being. That's lishtachavot. But lichroa ulishtachavot is something that is unique, and that is reserved for bowing down to God, as we recite in our daily prayers. V'anachnu kor'im u'mishtachavim u'modim. Lichroa ulishtachavot is a form of religious worship and not just a sign of respect. So it's possible that Mordechai refuses to bow down because Haman is set up as some kind of religious figure, some kind of idolatrous representative, and therefore Mordechai is identifying religiously as a Jew. The other suggestion is that Haman, of course, is known as an Agagi. Agag is understood by Chazal and arguably by the Tanakh itself as going back to the one other figure in the Tanakh known as Agag, and that is the king of Amalek, the one who was spared by Shaul HaMelech and ultimately killed by Shmuel HaNavi. And if Haman is an Agagi, that would identify him with the nation of Amalek. And of course, he's a worthy representative of that distinguished nation insofar as just as Amalek sought to destroy the Jewish people, Haman seeks to eradicate the Jewish people as a whole. And therefore, it's been argued that Mordechai refuses to bow down to Haman because a Jew cannot bow down to an Amalekite. Okay, he can bow down to other human beings, not to an Amalekite. Amalekite represents the height of wickedness, represents war against God and divine war against them. And therefore, on national grounds, Mordechai as a Jew, as a Yehudi, cannot bow down to Amalek. What is no less interesting than the question is as to why Mordechai refuses to bow down, which, as I've mentioned, is the first overtly Jewish act in the book of Esther, is the reaction. And here again, I think it's noteworthy to compare our book to the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel, self-identification as a Jew, and even mesirut nefesh, even willingness to martyr oneself on behalf of one's Jewishness, is something that earns the respect of the Gentiles. And perhaps that's why Mordechai felt that it was appropriate for him not to bow down to Haman. He thought that maybe that would also achieve the admiration of the surrounding people. What he doesn't take into account is something new that happens. Haman, when he's told, someone takes the trouble to inform Haman, this fellow sitting in the gate of the king is not bowing down to you. And Haman decides, well, if one Jew has sinned against me and sinned against the king, then all Jews deserve to die. We have a name for this kind of reaction. It's anti-Semitism. And this is really the first sign of anti-Semitism, possibly in the Tanakh, certainly in this historical time frame. And this anti-Semitism is really what sets in motion the events of the book. We're talking about a different galut than the galut. The same way we're talking about different Jews at this time than the Jews who lived at the time of Daniel, we're talking about a different galut as well. Okay, this is a much more inimical galut, a galut that is much less willing to accept the Jews on their own terms. And if datehem shonot mikolam v'tatei ha-melech einam osim, if they have their own laws and practices and beliefs, okay, then this is a cause for enmity and a cause for calling for their extermination. I'd like to mention some other aspects of Jewish identity that are not quite as explicit in the book. They're not presented in the book front and center, but they are alluded to rather obliquely. When the character of Mordechai is first presented towards the beginning of chapter 2 of Megillat Esther, okay, then the Mordechai is identified as follows. Okay, this is Perek Bet Pasuk Hey, for those who have Tanachim. Ish Yehudi haya b'shushan habira, shmor Mordechai, ben Yair, ben Shimi, ben Kishi, Shimini. He's given a very distinguished lineage, a lineage that in fact affiliates him with kingship. Okay, Kish, Ishimini is of course the father of Shaul ben Kish. So he is from the royal family, the royal lineage of Shaul HaMelech, which is of course interesting considering that Shaul was the one who fought the battle against Amalek. Asher hoglam Yerushalayim im hagola asher hogletam Yechoniah melech Yehudah asher hoglam Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel. And here in the next pasuk we're told about Mordechai as also representing Yerushalayim, also representing Yechoniah melech Yehudah. Okay, Mordechai is what remains from the kingdom of Judea, okay, the galut of Yechoniah. Mordechai is a descendant of someone who was sent out into that galut, okay, and Yerushalayim is mentioned. So we have the national motifs that are so prominently missing from the vast majority of the book of Megillat Esther, but they are briefly alluded to in presenting the character of Mordechai. And the question that we would like to pursue is, what happens to these motifs afterward? Afterward, they seem to disappear from the Megillah. But what we would like to argue is that, in fact, they are Megillat Esther. Okay, they may not be present b'galui in a revealed way, but they are present b'nistar in an encrypted fashion.
I'd like to just pursue a little bit more the topic that Avi mentioned about the genealogy of Mordechai and Esther. as being descendants of the house of Shaul. Actually, the battle between Amalek and Bnei Israel is a battle that's pretty much taken over by, we could say, the house of Rachel, the descendants of Rachel. First of all, we have Yoshua ben Nun, who was Mishevet Ephraim, descended from the house of the tribe of Ephraim, which is, of course, connected to Yosef. And he was really the first general who fought against the Amalekim in the Midbar. And then we have Shaul, who is a descendant of the house of Binyamin, of the Shevet of Binyamin, who is entrusted with the final destruction of Amalek. Of course, what happened then was that Shaul failed to kill Agag, and in addition, he did not obey the commandment to destroy all the shalal, all the booty, all the biza, and he took, as you recall, some of the cattle, and basically the cattle, the fine cattle from the Amalekim. And in addition, as you may also recall, that Shaul was commanded to utterly destroy Amalek, and this he did not do because he spared Agag, he spared the king. What we see is a kind of Gilgul, a kind of development, historical development, where we come to the story of Mordechai and Esther, who are part of that same house of Beit Rachel. Of course, Mordechai is also similar in many ways, as we've learned, to Yosef. He is also a rising star in the Galut, in the house of a foreign king. And interestingly, there's a kind of reversal here, because now the Jews, instead of the Amalekim, are threatened with Hashmadah, with total destruction. Fortunately, it does not happen. And when the Jews fight against their enemies, in the Persians, the Megillah tells us, Uva biza lo shalchu et yadam. They did not take any booty when they defeated their Persian enemies. So it's, I think the Megillah is hinting at the idea that there's a kind of tikkun, there's a kind of correction going on in the house of Rachel, among the descendants of Rachel. If the Shaul took at the time, he did not carry out the rule of not touching and not enjoying the booty from the Battle of Amalek, now his descendants, Mordechai and Esther, make it very clear to the Jews, Lo lishloch yadam, lo lishloch yadam babiza. They may not enjoy the booty. And that is because, among other things, the idea is we are not fighting this battle against our enemies in order to win money and wealth and to gain property. We are fighting a battle because we are threatened by them and we want to survive. It's a battle of survival, and it's not about wealth or money. So here we see, I think, a kind of echo of Malchut. We see a kind of that echo of Malchut that started, of kingship that started at the time of Shaul, somehow got aborted, somehow got side-roaded in a way, and now comes back in the form of Mordechai and Esther. Of course, again, because it's in Galut and it's not in the land of Israel, so it has to take its own kind of circuitous route. And in the end, of course, Mordechai is Mishneh LaMelech HaChashverosh. He is not the Melech, but he is the Mishneh, like Yosef. He will have power. He will enjoy power, but he will have to use it in a sort of a subtle way and not in an obvious kind of ruling. Okay.
As opposed to the theme of the themes of Jewish nationality and Jewish kingship that do seem to reappear, albeit in somewhat modified fashion, by the end of the book. The Jews have come together, lech knoset kol ha-yudim, the people were far flung, come together, nikalu, the Jews are nikalim, they come together. Okay, there seems to be a kind of reassertion of the Jews as a separate ethnic grouping within the Persian Empire. And as Ruthie noted, also the theme of being a Mishneh LaMelech. The Jews rise to positions of power, maybe even a Secretary of the Treasury, or other kinds of positions that were appropriate at that time. The other classic Jewish themes of Eretz Yisrael and of Yerushalayim do seem to be absent from the continuation of the Megillah. There's no, till the very end of the book, there's no further mention of Yerushalayim, no further allusion to Eretz Yisrael, and this is a point we'll come back to a bit further on. But what I would like to talk about now, before getting back to that point, is another kind of assertion of Jewish identity that takes place at the end of the book, and that is the institution of a new festival. Okay, after the Jews win the battle against their enemies, after they are able to hang Haman and his 10 sons on the gallows, after all this takes place, the Jews celebrate a festival. The festival that the Jews celebrate, in its very existence, is a kind of reassertion of Jewish identity. Okay, this is a Jewish festival. This is a festival that celebrates something that the Jews have accomplished, something that the Jews have experienced. And I think it's worth noting that this is also the very first festival that was established not by God, but by the people of Israel. In fact, what we are dealing with here, Megillat Esther, is the last book of the Tanakh, of the Torah Shebichtav, and perhaps it's not by accident that the name of God is absent from this book. God does not appear overtly, covertly. Certainly, it's very easy to see God operating behind the scenes, orchestrating the events. Most famously, when Haman shows up to request building a gallows on which to hang Mordechai, and finds the king exactly at the moment when he, having spent a sleepless night, has decided to reward Mordechai. Okay, so that's a marvelous piece of choreography that couldn't have been engineered by any human being. Obviously, we have the divine choreographer sitting upstairs and pulling the strings behind the scenes. So God is covertly in the book, but not overtly. And this is perhaps appropriate for the final book of the Tanakh, the final book of a period in Jewish history in which God speaks, God reveals himself. Okay, there are prophets, there are people who receive the direct word of God. And in the book of Esther, there is no one who receives the direct word of God. There are people who try to divine the will of God, try to guess what God might have in mind. Umi yodea im le'et kazot higa'at la'malchut. Okay? Why is it that you were appointed as queen? I've been wondering that. Someone engineered Esther's becoming queen. So why did that happen? So Mordechai begins to say, I'm getting a glimpse here of the divine plan. And this is Torah Shebal Peh. This is Jews learning to operate not in Eretz Yisrael but in Galut, not with immediate divine revelation, but in a world in which God is silent, and you have to try in this world to divine the will of God by following signs, by picking up on cues and clues and trying to understand what's going on. And I think it's highly appropriate that in such a book, at the conclusion of the book, you have the first institution legislated by the nation, not legislated by God to the nation, but legislated by the nation itself, which is also another aspect of Torah Sheba'al Peh. I'd like you to look at your source sheets at page two. Where is it? There should be. You don't have the source sheets?
No.
Page 3.
Page 3?
Yeah.
I'm also sure. Is the source sheet
around? 2, 1, 2. One second. Ah, yes.
Okay. What number?
page 3. Anyone?
I think we need it.
Yeah. Well, you seem to be missing.
We'll need that.
We'll get it back. We'll get it back.
Okay. Apologize for the mix-up. The source sheets somehow got lost in transit, and we didn't make enough copies. Okay, so please look at source 9 on page 3. Okay, what's called Shlavei Hitkablut Chag HaPurim. Okay, chapter 9, I would dare say, is probably the least popular and least read, and obviously the least understood chapter of the Megillah, and it seems, certainly in its second half, downright boring, because all you have is a repetition, again and again, of the Jews celebrated, and the Jews celebrated, and then Mordechai wrote down and said the Jews should celebrate, and then Mordechai and Esther wrote down and said the Jews should celebrate, and the Jews decided to celebrate, okay, and what's going on? Actually, if you look closely at these psukim, there's a very interesting narrative going on, but you have to read a little bit in between the lines. And in order to do so, you have to pay close attention to very, very sophisticated and, I would say, understated textual cues, okay, and see how things are presented at each stage. So if you look, you'll see there are actually 5 stages in which the festival of Purim, this new festival that's being legislated, takes place. The first stage, number 1, okay, I'll read the pasuk, "Ushar Yudim Asher Binyot HaMelech, Binoach Be'arba'asar Bo, V'asa Oto Yom Mishteh V'Simcha." Now I've highlighted some of the key words here so that you'll find it easier to follow. Okay? Then you have "Ayudim Asher B'Shushan, Asa Oto Yom Mishteh V'Simcha." So the festival is described here, first of all, as Yom Mishteh V'Simcha. Okay? A day of banqueting. Okay, Yimishtah means actually a drinking banquet. Bisimcha and rejoicing. That sounds like a nice festival. Okay, you drink and you rejoice. That's a nice little festival. And the Yehudim are doing it. The Jews are doing it. And the Yehudim Asher B'Shushan are doing it on a separate day. There are 2 days. One day for the Jews who finish their battle on the 13th, celebrate on the 14th. In Shushan, they finish their battle on the 14th, celebrate on the 15th. And this seems to be just a spontaneous celebration. You know, think about a city whose hockey team has just won the playoffs, and so the fans go out to celebrate. Nobody has to tell them to go out to celebrate. They just decide to do it all on their own. The next stage, Al Kein Ayudim Aprazim Osim Et Yom Arba Asar Lechodesh Adar Simcha Umishteh V'Yom Tov. The next stage is that a continuing celebration, osim, it's something that continues from year to year. So the first year everyone went out and celebrated spontaneously. The second, third, fourth, fifth, I don't know exactly how many years, the people are continuing this celebration as a commemoration. Curiously enough, it's only the Jews who live in unwalled cities, Ayudim Aprozim, that comes right out of left field. We have absolutely no idea who these Yehudim HaPrazim are. There's been no narrative preparation at all for differentiating between Jews who live in one kind of city or another kind of a city. And one of the 2 days has disappeared. Only the 14th day is being celebrated by the Jews in unwalled cities. That's a real enigma in the Megillah. We'll come back to discuss it in a few minutes. But first, let's notice what happens to the festival. The festival has now taken on a new character. It's no longer just drinking and rejoicing. Now it's Simcha U'Mishteh V'Yom Tov. Yom Tov seems to have more of an official character. In the Gemara, this is understood as alluding to being prohibited to work. Fortunately or not, that minhag was not accepted, and the word Yom Tov falls out of the later descriptions of the festival. Okay, it might just mean another term for rejoicing, but again, it seems to have more of an official character and less spontaneous, which is appropriate for what happens in future years. In the third stage, Vayichtov Mordechai et hadvarim ha'ilam. Mordechai writes this down. Okay? And he sends out letters to the people throughout the empire. L'kayem aleihem liot osim et yom arba'as alechodesh adar et yom chamisha asar bo b'chol shana v'shana. He sends out to all people, continue this practice. L'kayem aleihem. Please continue this practice. And in continuing the practice, he reinstates the 15th day. Doesn't say anything about who celebrates the 14th and who celebrates the 15th. Maybe all Jews are celebrating both days, or maybe, in fact, it's the division that's familiar to us today between walled and unwalled cities. That's not clear. Okay? And the character of the festival is Simcha Yemei Mishteh V'Simcha, as days of drinking banquets and rejoicing. Yom Tov has disappeared. Mishloach Manot continues. Mishloach Manot, by the way, we tend to think as being uniquely a Purim festivity, but actually this is a classic way of Jewish rejoicing. In the book of Nehemiah, chapter 8, this is described as a practice on Rosh Hashanah, and it seems to be a practice on all Jewish festivals, expressing the idea that you don't just rejoice for yourself, but you include other people in your rejoicing. Okay, no Jewish festivity is complete if it's just festivity of the individual, unless you include others in it. Okay, so this includes Mishloach Manot Ish L'Re'ehu, which already appeared first in number 2, but Mordechai, interestingly, includes a further stage, U'matanot Le'Avyonim. In other words, you don't only include your neighbor and friend in the rejoicing, which is an important Jewish practice, but an even more important Jewish practice is to seek out the people who are unfortunate, even if they may not live nearby, even if they're not your neighbors or your friends. And this, I think, gives Purim a kind of communal character. You accept responsibility for the community as a whole. Okay, so we see the festival slowly developing a more Jewish character, and interestingly, it's only when the leadership steps in that it gains this character of matanot livyonim, of communal responsibility. The Rambam has famously stated that the main mitzvah one should care about on Purim and invest most energy and resources in is matanot levyonim. And if he doesn't do so, then it's not a Jewish simcha, it's simcha takares. Your belly is rejoicing, but the Jew is not rejoicing. For a Jew to rejoice, it's important not only to make your belly happy, okay, but to discharge this communal responsibility as well. Stage number 4, okay, stage number 4 includes that the people, in fact, accepted what Mordechai had decreed. And stage number 5, interestingly, is a second set of letters was sent out. And it seems that even though it said that the people accepted Mordechai, it seems that the acceptance was not as deep, perhaps not as universal as one would have liked, or perhaps not as lasting as one might have liked. And therefore, Esther now steps into the breach. Okay, and Esther takes charge, and she, together with Mordechai, sends out a second group of letters. And finally, at the end stage number 5, it's written in the book. And at this point, the Megillah notes that this holiday of Purim will never be forgotten and will always be observed. This is an eternal holiday that will become part and parcel of the Jewish calendar for all generations. So what we see is a picture of a holiday that starts from below as a spontaneous initiative, then becomes a communal practice, then the leadership steps in and gives it a new character, adds some new details, perhaps detracts one or two details, okay, and finally, where it becomes written down in a book, then it becomes an integral part of the celebration of the Jewish calendar.
I don't know what that noise is. Purim maintains, nevertheless, despite what Avi said about sort of adopting Jewish characteristics, yet it still has something of the Persian, I think, the Persian character to it. One of the odd things about Purim that we feel very strongly is, and in Israel, is that Purim is celebrated on two different days, which means that there's something not unifying about Purim. When if you live outside of Yerushalayim and you want to invite guests from Yerushalayim, then there's a complication. And it always seemed odd to me, what kind of Jewish holiday can there be where all the Jews do not celebrate at the same time? And I think it's a reflection of something that remains within the Jewish people, something divisive, something not quite unified, which is reflected so much in the Megillah, where the identity of the Jews is really not clear-cut. And the other anomaly, I think, of Purim is the whole aspect of mishteh, of drinking. I mean, we know that this is the one time a year, or maybe twice a year, or maybe Simchat Torah also, where Jews are really encouraged to drink. And it's based probably on the idea that the mishteh is so central in Persian life. As a matter of fact, the word mishteh appears more in Sefer Migdash Esther than it does in any other book in the Tanakh. And indeed, there are famously 10 mishtaot, 10 drinking parties in the Megillah. The first five are hosted by non-Jews, whether it be Achashverosh and Haman, or Achashverosh hosting everybody or making a party for Esther or Vashti's party. And the last five are all hosted by one Jew or another, whether it be Esther hosting the party for Haman and Achashverosh. And afterwards, the mishtaot that Avi mentioned, the ones commemorating the 14th and the 15th days of rest from the victory. And what divides the two sets of mishtaot, interestingly, is the tzom. The tzom, al tochlu v'al tishtu, shloshet yamim v'laila v'yom. The fasting that Esther institutes for 3 days and three nights, kind of tough, but okay, kind of sets the dividing line between the Persian type of mishteh and our type of mishteh. Nevertheless, we still kind of, I think, hold on to that sort of vestige of Persian festivity when we celebrate our Chag. Our Chag of Purim has such a duality to it. Even the name Purim, it's a plural. It's Pur, Al Shem HaPur. Pur was the, you know, the throwing the lots. But Purim has this duality to it. It has a Jewish identity to it, but it still has some of the vestige of the Persian culture that we were so much a part of in those days.
What I'd like to conclude with is perhaps the most enigmatic search in the Megillah is to hunt for references to Eretz Yisrael and to Yerushalayim in this final part of the Megillah. And if there is an allusion to it, and I'm not 100% sure that there is, but if there is, the allusion would be through this very enigmatic pasuk that I alluded to earlier, the Yehudim HaPrazim HaYoshvim Ba'arei HaPrazot. This term Prazim appears in two other places in the Tanakh, both of which are mentioned in Talmudic sources in connection with Megillat Esther. One of them is in the book of Dvarim. Okay? In the conquest of Eretz Yisrael, in particular here we're talking about the extended Eretz Yisrael, Transjordan, okay, in Ever HaYarden, in the conquest from Og Melech HaBashan, it says Milvad Me'arei HaPrazim. Okay, so Arei Prazim were part of the conquest of Eretz Yisrael, and therefore it's arguable, and I've alluded before to Dr. Yoni Grossman's recent book. He argues, in fact, that Prazim in the Megillah is an allusion to the community of Israel, and Ruthie mentioned earlier that there's a kind of divide at the beginning of the book between the center in Persia and the center in Eretz Yisrael. And Dr. Grossman suggests that at the end of the book as well, there's a kind of tension going on between the center in Persia and the center in Eretz Yisrael. But there's another allusion to Prozim in the Tanakh. Okay, here it's actually written a little bit differently. In the book of Zechariah, there's a prophecy, Prazot Teshev Yerushalayim. Okay, Yerushalayim will, in Messianic times, be spread out. It will spread out beyond the wall. There will be no wall. Okay, today Yerushalayim is a walled city. Yerushalayim ultimately will be a spread out city without a wall. That's a sign of the burgeoning, flourishing of the center in Yerushalayim. And perhaps Prazim could be an oblique allusion to Yerushalayim as well. And that seems to be, in fact, the way the Talmud understood, starting from the Mishnah. Okay? If you look at source number 10, see an interesting phenomenon. Since this day was devoted to Tanakh, I didn't have much of a chance to talk about my favorite topic, which is Mishnah. Okay? But Megillat Esther gives me an opportunity to, in fact, weave in an insight into Mishnah, and that insight into Mishnah will also afford us an insight into Megillat Esther. At the beginning of the first chapter of Tractate Megillah, Megillah Nikrate, and we have a list of dates. Some of the dates are for Kfarim, those are outlying villages, okay, which have sparse population, and particularly don't have, as the Mishnah explains later, don't have a regular minyan. They don't have Asara Batlanim. It's interesting, people who come to minyan are called Batlanim. Those of you who know Hebrew will appreciate that. Then you have Arim, okay? Then you have Arim, Ayarot Gdolot, so the Kfarim read either on the 10th or the 11th or the 12th, either 11th, 12th, 13th, or 14th of Adar. The Ayarot read always on the 14th of Adar, unless it falls on Shabbat. Okay, and then, if you look at line 2, source 10, Mishnah Aleph, line 2. Krachin hamukafin choma mimot Yoshua binun korin b'chamishasar. Okay, walled cities from the time of Yehoshua bin Nun will read on the 15th. Okay, they read on the 15th. So, the Mishnah has suggested a solution to the enigma we had in the Megillah. What exactly happened when the Yehudim Prazim, Ayoshvim Barea Prazot, celebrated on the 14th? What about the other Jews? What about the Jews who lived in walled cities? What did they do? Some have argued, interestingly, the Ramban argues they didn't celebrate at all for reasons that we don't have time to go into. But the answer of the Mishnah is the ones who lived in the walled cities celebrated on the 15th. The festival of Shushan passed on to those who lived in the walled cities. Why? Why the walled cities? And why does the Mishnah define walled cities not in terms of the generation in which the miracle of Purim happened, but in terms of the generation of conquest of the land under Yoshua bin Nun? The classic answer to that is that at the time, Israel had no walled cities. There was a return to the land, but the Jews, as Ruthie mentioned at the beginning of our talk, the Jews in the land of Israel were struggling. They did not have the wherewithal or the ability or the numbers to create walled cities. And so in order to accord honor to Eretz Israel, they said, in all cities that once were walled cities, that were traditionally walled cities, namely, there were walled cities at the time of the conquest of Yehoshua, that's the time that will define walled cities for this generation as well. But there's another aspect to this special celebration for walled cities. Okay, and I'll come back to Ruthie's question. Why are Jews not all celebrating the same day? Why do you have a division? So Ruthie suggested, and I think the idea is correct, that it shows that there's still an internal division. We don't yet have a united nation that can celebrate all together the way biblical holidays are celebrated. This first holiday of the Torah Sheba'al Peh in Galut still retains a character of Jews who are not fully united, cannot get together to celebrate on one day. Everyone has the shul they don't go into, and everyone has the Purim they don't celebrate. Okay? I think that idea is true. But I think there's another idea, and the Mishnah alludes to it. Because at the end of the chapter, the Tractate Megillah famously has, in its first chapter, a long section that seems on the surface to have nothing to do with reading the Megillah. Almost every topic under the halachic sun is discussed in this collection of Mishnayot Ein Dein. All the Mishnayot share an opening of Ein Dein. Okay, there's nothing, the only differences between A and B are certain minute or relatively minor differences. And this list, which seems on the surface to have nothing to do with reading the Megillah, concludes with the following. We're back again in Source 10, Mishnah Yud Aleph. Ein ben shilo lirushalayim, ela shabeshilo ochlim kodashim kalim, maser sheni b'chol haro'eh, uvirushalayim lifnim min hachoma. Okay, the difference between Shiloh and Yerushalayim, Shiloh, of course, was also a sanctuary. There was a sanctuary that lasted for hundreds of years built in Shiloh. Okay, and then there was a more permanent sanctuary built in Yerushalayim. The Mishnah says there's only one halachic difference between Shiloh and Yerushalayim, and that is where one can eat sacred foods. Sacred foods in Shiloh can be eaten anywhere where you can see the city. But sacred foods can be eaten in Yerushalayim only within the wall. The chapter that opens with the walled cities, okay, in which you read the Megillah on the 15th, closes with the wall of Yerushalayim. Interestingly, and we don't have time to look at these sources together, but I invite you to look at them after the talk, in sources 11 and 12, we have two other references in the Mishnah. These are the only three references in all of the Mishnah to walled cities in Halakha. And in both of those cases, walled cities are presented as being a stage below Jerusalem. The wall of Jerusalem, okay, the second source, number 12, describes Eretz Yisrael as having 10 levels of sanctity. Eretz Yisrael itself, then you have walled cities as being another level of sanctity, and then you have lifnim min hachoma, inside the wall of Jerusalem, is the next level, and the next levels take you inside the temple proper. And so, in fact, when the sages established that we should read the Megillah on a special day on the inside walled cities, I believe that the Mishnah is teaching us that this is to indicate that this is a festival in which Yerushalayim is not present. The Jews have not settled Jerusalem, established a temple that can unite the entire Jewish people. Maybe there is a temple at the time, depending on what the exact historical frame is, or this could be at a time when they're still jockeying around and politicking as to whether the temple will be allowed to be built. Many midrashim indicate that that's the case. Whether the temple stands or not, the temple is not the focus of the festival. The festival starts in unwalled cities, moves up to walled cities, and this is perhaps a way of saying we haven't yet arrived inside the wall of Jerusalem. We've gotten only to the next level, to the walls outside of Jerusalem. Okay? And perhaps, and this is perhaps the ultimate expression of the galut nature of the festival of Purim, Purim is presented as a festival in progress. Okay? You start with the outlying communities, you move to larger communities, then you move to walled communities. And each one of these represents a more united, okay, a more crystallized community hanging together and looking up towards the next stage. The next stage is Yerushalayim. And so the walled cities celebrate on the 15th. That's the classic date for a Torah festival. That's the date that will be celebrated exactly 1 month later on Pesach. The same Pesach that, as Ruthie mentioned, was not observed at the time of the Megillah. That Pesach is what we're looking forward towards, okay, as we celebrate Purim. And so what I'm suggesting is that the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the real Torah Sheba'al Peh, the Mishnah, perhaps reveals to us what the last work of the Torah Shebichtav really has in mind and left unfinished. That the festival of Purim is an important festival. It's an important step towards reestablishing Jewish identity. It's not the ultimate step. It's a step that points forward towards the next level, the ultimate redemption, symbolized by the next festival, the festival of Pesach. Thank you very much.
Just one more sentence. It just struck me now that the allusion to Yehoshua ben Nun ties in with what we spoke about, that Mordechai and Esther are part of the same family, the house of Yosef. And perhaps when we commemorate Yehoshua, we're also saying, Yehoshua, you were the progenitor of, in some sense, of Mordechai and Esther. And the holiday of Purim, we want to remember you as well. And also to tie in with Mukafot Choma, the idea that Yehoshua ben Nun was the main conqueror of Eretz Yisrael. So we try.
And brought down the walls of Jericho.
And brought down the walls of Jericho. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry, you introduced yourselves, but really, if you talk on unity, I think this is the first time ever in Torah Motion we've had a back-to-back shir, like, you know, two people are united, a husband and wife, which is the height of unity, and, you know, that's a beautiful way. Ish l're'ehu, which is, of course, Re'u in Chazal is understood as a spouse. So I want to thank you for the really very, very a fascinating shir, and I want to thank everybody. I think it was a wonderful day of learning. And just as a point, what I mentioned earlier, if you didn't hear, if you'd like to get the MP3s of the shirim you missed, because you couldn't be at all, only I could be at all of them. I sort of a little here, a little there. But so just if we don't send it to you, because if you registered online, that's great. That's the way it's supposed to be. If you didn't register online, maybe easier if you send us an email, info@turnmotion.org, and we'll send it all off to you. And have a great day, and enjoy the Yimei Mishteh U'Simcha, Mishanichnas Adar Marvim V'Simcha.